Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to a new podcast interview for New Books in East Asian Studies series, which is part of the New Books Network. I'm Roman Pashka, and my interlocutor today is Takashi Miura, who is an assistant professor with the Department of East Asian Studies at the University of Arizona, and who published last year, 2019, a book titled Agents of World Renewal, The Rise of Yonaoshi Gods in Japan, with the University of Hawaii Press. Hello, Takashi, and thank you for agreeing to talk to us today.
No, thank you. Thank you for your time, and thank you for this opportunity for an interview. Thank you.
I'd like to start by asking you about yourself, about your background. How did you become interested in this field? How did the idea for the research project come about? If you could tell us a few things about yourself.
Sure. So I have a very broad interest in millenarian beliefs. I guess you could say apocalyptic beliefs. The notion that that the world is coming to an end, a radically new world is going to emerge, often accompanied by destructive transformation of the world. This might have to do with the fact that I grew up in Japan in the 90s. This kind of rhetoric or discourse was very popular then. I guess it's popular still now. So I've always had that kind of interest. And that was initially the motive for pursuing education in religious studies, just wanting to find out more about these things in different parts of the world. And for graduate school, I just ended up combining that broad interest in religious studies with my, I guess, fascination or also interest in the Bakumatsu period. I've always liked late Tokugawa history, late Tokugawa society, and the beginning of the Meiji period. And I just like that whole history. So for my graduate my PhD project, I ended up combining my interest in millenarian beliefs and late Tokugawa history studies. And as an undergrad, I read a lot of books about, late Tokugawa history and religion. And I was told in those books that the idea of world renewal, Yonaoshi, is an example of millenarian thinking in Japanese religion. So that is initially how I started working on this project on Yonaoshi or world renewal, thinking that I would be able to study about millenarian or form of millenarianism in Japanese history. But it turned out the more I looked, the less millenarianism I found in this book. And that's one of the central arguments in this book, that we have to really reevaluate the notion of world renewal or Yonaoshi in Japanese history or Japanese religious history. That's sort of the how I came up with, or how I arrived at the current book project.
Okay. Since you started talking about the book, may I ask you to give us some more details about the book itself, the structure, the chapters, maybe some of the most important points, something that you would like the readers to take away from your book.
Sure. So the common narrative or the way that Toka history or Bakumatsu history is presented is that as the power of the Tokugawa Bakufu was declining in the early to mid 19th century, you know, people started to express desires for a new world, a radically new world order, as it were. And the way they expressed this sentiment, this millenarian sentiment, was through the language of world renewal. And this sentiment manifested, for example, very vividly in a phenomena that's often described as Asian Aika in 1867, where people danced on the streets calling for world renewal, a new world to emerge. And that popular uprising helped to collapse the Tokugawa government and led to the rise of Japan, or the birth of Japan as a modern nation. So there was this idea that world renewal, or the idea of Yonaoshi in late Tokugawa society, was this millenarian impetus that made possible, that made Meiji Restoration possible. And that, I think that's a very typical narrative. What I do in this book is I challenge that narrative by, first of all, pointing out that the idea of Yonaoshi has a much longer history than simply the 19th century. It wasn't a Bakumatsu-specific concept. And that by simply tracing the history of this, or the conceptual history of Yonaoshi, we see a very different aspect of late Tokugawa history, and which is that in this idea of world renewal doesn't really take on a millenarian characteristic until actually the modern period. The idea of Yonaoshi becomes millenarian only in the modern period, well into the Meiji period. And by doing that, I problematize this idea that people in late Tokugawa society were, you know, calling for this millenarian transformation of the world, and directly connecting that to the fall of the Bakufu. I try to problematize that narrative. That when we actually look at the history of the concept of world renewal itself, we see a much more localized visions or of communal renewal, that in the late Tokugawa period, Yonaoshi almost always had to do with specific economic problems like high taxes, high prices of goods, and other specific economic problems that are based in local communities, and didn't really have anything to do with this millenarian remaking of the world. And one of my arguments in the book is that this elaborate notion of world renewal or Yonaoshi was basically a scholarly construction that came out of basically 20th century Japanese Marxist historiography, that there was this desire to see popular revolutionary fervor in late Tokugawa society, and sort of retrospectively trying to locate these sentiments of revolution. And so my book is, in a sense, an attempt to undo all of that in one respect, and try to understand Yonaoshi or world renewal in its own context, historical context, if that makes sense.
Sure. I mean, I was just thinking that when I was reading your book, I found it fascinating how you show that this whole Yonaoshi thing, the increasing popularity of yonaoshi in the late, starting with the late 18th century, actually is part of a bigger trend, if I understand your point correctly.
Yes, right.
I think you talk about this yonaoshi trend as part of an interest in economic blessings, immediate relief that would be granted by the divinities, and that yonaoshi provides this kind of relief, which is in many cases tangible. But you also stress the fact that this happens more or rather within the community where the yonaoshi god is celebrated or venerated. If I hope I understand
right.
your point.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Okay.
So the way I approach the subject of yonaoshi or world renewal is, and thanks for bringing this up and reminding me of the main point of the book, is that there is a series of gods, divinities that were upheld as gods of world renewal, and that these gods became very prevalent in late Tokugawa society, starting in the late 18th century, actually, and their popularity lasted until all the way up to the Taisho period in modern Japan. And what I argue in the book is that in the Tokugawa period, these yonaoshi gods, world renewing gods, were basically providers of economic benefits. These, to give you concrete examples, these would be peasants who are deified as world renewing gods or world renewing kami in peasant protests. I also talk about an example of a low ranking samurai who assassinates basically an elder in the Tokugawa government. And because this elder was hugely unpopular, the samurai gets deified as a world renewing kami. And I frame it in terms of, yeah, this continuing trend in Japanese religion of, you know, emphasizing immediate this worldly benefits, right? And I do that partly because in order to demonstrate that this idea of world renewal or yonaoshi didn't always have this subversive characteristic that scholars tend to associate this concept with, that it's inadequate to try to understand this idea only in relation to, say, the Meiji Restoration or the transition between the Tokugawa and the Meiji periods. We have to contextualize it or place it in, I guess, a longer historical viewpoint or vantage point. And so I also talk about about cases where Tokugawa bureaucrats get deified as world renewing gods. And these were not subversive figures at all. These were bureaucrats, very loyal Tokugawa rulers, who would implement these anti-poverty measures and would therefore get deified by the local communities as world renewing gods. And that notion of yonaoshi, I think, is completely opposite of what we have as scholars of Japan have said about this idea. And I kind of go back to the point about world renewal or yonaoshi being a historiographical category that scholars have constructed over the years, and how that's different from the actual expression yonaoshi that we find in primary sources. And that gap is something that I highlight in the book.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
I found it absolutely fascinating how you you try to perform this anatomy of Yonaoshi, let's say reevaluation of Yonaoshi. You present all these cases. It's basically case studies, right? Between the late 18th century and early 20th century. And there were two cases in particular that I found really fascinating. The first one, I think it's the one that you just mentioned about the samurai. You're talking about Sano Masakoto, right?
Correct, yeah.
The episode at the end of the 18th century that you actually describe in the introduction to the book, right? Mm-hmm. And where he kills the Tanuma family member, and that happens right. to coincide with a drop in the rice price, if I remember correctly, right?
That's and right.
So he ends up being venerated by the people as a an agent of world renewal. And the other episode that I found fascinating was the Chichibu incident.
Yeah.
The uprising in the Chichibu County. That was also, it was, first of all, it was nice to read for somebody who is interested in, I'm also, the focus of my research is the Tokugawa period. My approach is totally different. Uh-huh. I'm looking at, philosophy in the Tokugawa mm-hmm. period. But it's really interesting to see all these developments happening in the Tokugawa period and re-evaluations that we're doing right now. And mm-hmm. I actually had a question in mind. I'm sorry, I'm digressing, but I had a question in mind.
Go ahead.
So when performing this anatomy of this re-evaluation of Yonaoshi, you talk about how these incidents or these cases of Yonaoshi arose spontaneously and mm-hmm. that they were not necessarily religious in nature. I mean, you talk in your book about how in order to document the whole Yonaoshi phenomenon, you went beyond religious texts. So you looked at texts mm-hmm. And documents, materials that are not religious in nature. Right. And you mentioned government records, official records, memoirs, and so on and so forth. My question was, what is the is there a balance between this religious side and the non-religious side to the Yonaoshi phenomenon? Was it perceived mm-hmm. as something completely, totally religious at the time, or was it seen as this worldly rather?
Uh-huh. Yeah, I mean, that's a question that I'm still actually thinking about because the only I'm a religious studies scholar. But this book, it's really hard to describe this book in terms of, you know, using traditional religious studies categories. For example, you know, is this a book about Shinto? I mean, I talk about kami quite a bit, but, I don't think the word Shinto ever comes up in any of the sources that I look at. Is this a book about Buddhism? Well, I do talk about a few Buddhist temples, but you know, this book is not an example of, you know, traditional sort of Buddhological methodology in any sense. The only chapter that deals with, say, a religious organization or movement specifically is the last chapter on Omoto, where I talk about the reinterpretation of the idea of world renewal in Omotokyo, in this particular religious new religion in the late 19th century and early 20th century. But other than that, you're right that other sources, primary sources that I look at are primarily, I guess you could say, non-religious texts. But in a sense, I mean, if we, in a sense, remove or we don't confine ourselves to, you know, our notion of, you know, what religion is supposed to be, I think that would allow for more, you know, flexibility in a sense. If we stick to the, you know, our sort of modernist conception of what religion is supposed to be, many of these gods that I'm talking about, these localized divinities, would simply seem, I guess, irrelevant or obscure, insignificant. One of the aims of this book is to highlight this religious practice on the ground, so to speak, without the you know, all the elaborate, I guess, textual traditions that one might associate with a religious, you know, tradition in the organizational sense. So I don't really use the category of popular religion or folk religion either, because I think that those categories are also problematic. I guess one framework would be maybe this is an example of, you know, a study of local religions or community-based religions. You know, what did religious practices look like for, you know, ordinary villagers, members of local communities? Where to draw that boundary between what counts as religion and what doesn't count as religion? I didn't really delve into that in this book. But insofar as I'm talking about gods, I think I am dealing with religion in the broadest sense. Yes.
Okay. Yeah, one of the reasons why I asked this question is that when you're dealing with Tokugawa religion or philosophy, I think sometimes I find it really problematic to even use categories such as religion or or philosophy. And in fact, I think you just answered my next question, but I'm just going to ask it anyway. So my next question was actually about something that you state in the conclusion to your book, where you talk about, if I may quote, I think it's page 176, you say the rise of Yonaoshi gods is a significant development that mostly took place outside the confines of former religious institutions and represents an example of religious traditions that do not conform neatly to established boundaries or classification schemes. I think you just answered my question. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. But that's a point that I think is worth reflecting a little bit more, in the sense that I think the field of religious studies has, you know, moved on tremendously, progressed tremendously from, you know, moving beyond the traditional modality of, you know, basically studying religious institutions. And people have been saying this for a while now, that wouldn't it be nice to be able to study, I guess, non-institutionalized or, I guess, more, or forms of religions that are more diffused in local communities. But it's often sort of mentioned as an attachment or as an afterthought almost. And no one really, there aren't too many people who, engage in that kind of research, at least in the North American academic context. And I, at the same time, I also don't want to, you know, make this, you know, distinction, this clear distinction between institutionalized religion and non-institutionalized religions. I mean, I think these are the boundaries very porous. And I think, the fact is that religious institutions always exist in a community or in communities, and they are never detached from, you know, concrete lives of ordinary people. So I don't want to make that distinction too clear either, but I do think that we still have a tendency to rely on doctrinal texts that religion proper is expressed in these, texts produced by religious professionals and religious experts. And this book, other than the last chapter on Omoto, really tries to go beyond that traditional boundary of religious studies. I'm not saying that that traditional methodology is, you know, useless or meaningless, but I think by looking at sources other than those and using these other non-traditional sources, there are ways to bring new conversations into religious studies or Japanese religious studies in particular.
I see. That actually brings me to my next question, which is still something that is to be found in the in your conclusion to the book, where you it's the last part of the conclusion, actually, when you you write that you're not necessarily against the use of the term yonaoshi as a historiographical category, but you say that scholars should be aware that the emic yonaoshi and the etic yonaoshi are different. And yeah, I wanted to ask for more details about this, the distinction that you make here between the emic yonaoshi and the etic yonaoshi.
Sure. Yeah. So, you know, this, again, I kind of go back to what I said earlier about, you know, how I originally started, you know, doing the research. Again, being interested in this overall, this broad millenarian or study of millenarianism, I started this research thinking or hoping that yonaoshi, right, this notion of world renewal would be an example of millenarianism in Japanese history or Japanese religion. And that's, you know, how I started on this path for to begin with. But then, you know, in the course of my research, I actually started looking at, you know, the expression yonaoshi in primary sources. And at one point I realized that yonaoshi that I see in primary sources is very different from yonaoshi as discussed by academics, scholars, mostly historians, right? And also religious studies scholars. Again, in religious studies and also in historical terms, yonaoshi or world renewal is often presented as this grand millenarian conception. And that's what I refer to as the etic use or historiographical use of this term. And that term is often used in the context of discussing Tokugawa, late Tokugawa history and its transition into the Meiji period, that this, there's this popular millenarian fervor in the mid 19th century, right? Particularly strong around the years in the 1860s. But then I realized all of that is very much distant from or is distinct from the actual expression yonaoshi in primary sources. And that's the emic concept that I think that I highlight in this book through the case studies or examples of yonaoshi gods or world renewing gods. And some people might think of this book as like a like anti-Marx book or something like that, because the kind of historiography that I'm critiquing in the book is based on a certain sense of normative, you know, 20th century Japanese Marxist historiography, where everything is defined in terms of class struggle or, you know, subversive characteristics of popular movements. But when looking at the emic conception, we see a very different picture. As I said, it's not, yonaoshi was not always subversive. Even within the context of peasant protest, where certain peasants were deified as world-renewing gods, the Onawashigami, they would often make very concrete economic demands like lower taxes, lower prices of goods. And once those demands were fulfilled, they would back down. As far as I know, there was not a single case of Yonaoshi God, you know, trying to take on the Tokugawa government or something like that, you know, in that direct, in a direct way, right? So that's the distinction between the etic and emic that I'm making, and by making this distinction, and we all use scholarly categories, historiographical categories. We can't not use those categories, but there are sometimes cases where when we rely too much on this reified scholarly categories, we lose sight of basic emic conceptual history. And I guess I am saying that in this book that we have been, I think, misunderstanding this concept of world renewal as far as the, you know, late Tokugawa society is concerned. And by looking at the emic history, we see a very different picture of late Tokugawa society.
Okay. Thank you for clarifying that for me. The other thing that I wanted to ask you, which is not necessarily or not directly related to the book, is that I follow you on Twitter. Sure. I'm not even sure this is an appropriate question, but I'm going to ask anyway. Sure. And I see that periodically you tweet, for example, images, representations of woodblock prints, of representations of Yonaoshi gods. And sometimes you say, this is not in the book. This is not included in the book.
All right. Yes.
My question was if this is an ongoing research interest for you or...
Images that that I've been tweeting about, images not in the book, that came out of my frustration of not being able to use all of these cool images that I had, that I had collected over the years. But, you know, university presses don't, you know, they're concerned about the cost of reproducing images, right? So, okay, I'll just use these images on Twitter and kind of share them via this social media platform. But the examples that I don't do this as frequently as I used to, but I do post woodblock prints of, earthquake catfish, this legendary or this mythical catfish that supposedly caused a major earthquake in Edo in 1855. And this catfish basically through the earthquake was said to revitalize the flow of wealth in Edo society and was deified or as treated as a divinity of sort in these woodblock prints. So I do post about it from time to time, but those are directly sort of related to the book. And that came out mostly out of my frustration of not being able to use all these cool images I had collected over the years. Yeah.
And since we're talking about research projects, as we're approaching the end of the interview, I wanted to ask you about your current research projects. What are you working on right now?
Yes. So I'm working on my second project right now. And I'm building off of my first book on Yonaoshi gods. And I'm looking at specifically at cases where peasants get deified as kami, often in the context of peasant protests. And in the first book, in the book that was published, last year, I talked about specific cases where the language of world renewal was invoked in peasant protests. But in the second book, I'm interested more broadly in the phenomenon of peasant deification. And I'm tentatively arguing that this is a development unique to the Tokugawa period or to early modern Japan. In the medieval period, we see examples of, you know, warriors and aristocrats, religious professionals becoming kami or being deified. But in the early modern period, we start to see regular, ordinary villagers, peasants, being deified. And I'm looking at the most famous example, prominent example of this is the case of Sakura Sogoro from the Sakura domain. He was reportedly a peasant in the Sakura domain, present-day Chiba Prefecture, in the mid-17th century. He protested against the government because of high taxes, but he was executed by the government. But he came back as a vengeful spirit to curse the domain lord and all the people that contributed to his execution, and eventually he was deified. And I'm developing a project centered on this figure of Sogoro, Sakura Sogoro, and also discussing more broadly this phenomenon of peasant deification. That's the next project.
That sounds fascinating, and I'm actually looking forward to your next book. And when it's out, maybe we have time to get together again for another interview.
Sounds great.
Okay. Is there anything else you would like to add about the book?
Yes. Sure. Okay.
Yes.
So
okay.
Who can benefit from this book? A teacher or educator of Japanese history, and you would like, say, an updated chapter on Eijanaika, the phenomenon of, people dancing on the streets, right, on the eve of the Meiji Restoration. I have a chapter on that. I think that mm-hmm. chapter can be useful in talking about, the Meiji Restoration or the mid-19th century in general. The chapter about the earthquake catfish, I think, has very interesting images. I think your students would enjoy learning about that. And overall, the book, if you would like an example of, research that challenges this normative history of late Tokugawa and early Meiji period, right, is based on the subversive notion of world renewal or millenarian remaking of the world, I think my book would be a nice antithesis or counter viewpoint to that, I guess, dominant historiographical paradigm in Japanese history or religious history.
Okay, Takashi, thank you so much for talking to us about your book, and good luck with the new research project, and hopefully we'll meet again to talk about your new book in the near future.
Sounds great. Thank you.
Thank you, Takashi. So this was Takashi Miura, who is an assistant professor with the Department of East Asian Studies at the University of Arizona, and author of Agents of World Renewal, The Rise of Yonaoshi Gods in Japan, published in 2019 by the University of Hawaii Press. Thank you, Takashi, again. This has been a new episode in the New Books in East Asian Studies series. See you soon.